They'll dig up your heart, tear out your lungs, build you a leg to stand on, if it's any help. But you can bend and you can break. You'll learn to burn, you'll learn to drink. We got a bridge to nowhere. We got a road that kills. We got polluted water. And we got naked hills. And that's progress. But it don't look good to me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Up next is Rising Up Sonali.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the first night of a two-part Democratic presidential candidate debate took place Tuesday night, with 10 out of 20 hopefuls vying to make their case to the public. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were both part of the first night and two of the top four frontrunners, as per polls. Defying the predictions of media pundits, Sanders and Warren refrained from attacking one another and emerged as powerful advocates of bread-and-butter issues for voters, especially on the issue of health care. Both progressive stalwarts were a bulwark of visionary ideas relative to the rest of the more moderate candidates who urged reformist approaches. Arguing against Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan over the Medicare for All bill, Sanders fought back against the naysayers.
Dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
But you don't know.
Second
that.
Of all.
You don't know that.
Second
Bernie.
Of all.
We'll come to you in a second,
Congressman. I do know, and I wrote the damn bill.
Sanders also hit back at former Maryland Congressman John Delaney, accusing him of wanting to make money off of health care.
On the Medicare for All, the hospitals will save substantial sums of money because they're not going to be spending a fortune doing billing and the other bureaucratic things that they have to do today. Second of all, maybe you did that and made money off of health care, but our job is to run a nonprofit health care system.
That's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on the first night of the Democratic presidential candidate debate. Senator Elizabeth Warren also clashed with Delaney, issuing a retort that emerged as the winning line of the night and highlighting the differences between the progressives and the reformists.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
That's Elizabeth Warren on Tuesday night at the debate. Warren and Sanders also both accused CNN, which was hosting the debate, and other candidates of echoing Republican talking points.
And we should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk with each other about how to best provide that health care.
And Jake, your question is a Republican talking point. At the end of the day, and by the way, the healthcare industry will be advertising tonight on this program.
Thank you, Senator.
That's Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the first night of the Democratic presidential debates. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Peter Buttigieg also made a critical point on how Democrats could take bold positions.
It is time to stop worrying about what the Republicans will say. Look, yes. If it's true that if we embrace a far-left agenda, they're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists. If we embrace a conservative agenda, you know what they're going to do? They're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists. So let's just stand up for the right policy, go out there and defend it.
That's Buttigieg on the first night of the debate. Author and spiritual guru Marianne Williamson distinguished herself from other candidates on the issue of reparations for the descendants of enslaved Americans.
$200 to $500 billion payment of a debt that is owed. That is what reparations is. We need some deep truth-telling when it comes. We don't need another commission to look at evidence. I appreciate what Congressman O'Rourke has said. It is time for us to simply realize that this country will not heal. All that a country is a collection of people. People heal when there's some deep truth-telling. We need to recognize that when it comes to the economic gap between blacks and whites in America, it does come from a great injustice that has never been dealt with.
That's Marianne Williamson, presidential candidate. We'll have in-depth analysis of the two nights of debate later this week. The Trump administration has announced that it will create a plan to allow Americans to import lower-cost prescription drugs from Canada, just days after presidential candidate Bernie Sanders took a caravan of diabetes patients across the border to buy insulin. There is already a law allowing the importation of drugs, but government agencies have not approved it, claiming drug safety issues. And the White House announced that Trump will visit Central Florida next week for a discussion on the Medicare program and how his administration plans to strengthen it. In other news, the ACLU informed a federal judge that President Donald Trump's administration has separated nearly 1,000 immigrant children from their parents at the U.S. border after the government was ordered to stop family separations. The Washington Post reported that among the justifications that authorities made for the separations were these two stories. Quote, one migrant lost his daughter because a U.S. Border Patrol agent claimed that he had failed to change the girl's diaper. Another migrant lost his child because of a conviction on a charge of malicious destruction of property with alleged damage of $5. Kevin McAleenan, acting Homeland Security Secretary, had only recently testified to Congress that family separations after last year's court order remained, quote, exceedingly rare. One-fifth of the 911 children separated from their parents are under the age of five. Authorities in California found that the shooter in Gilroy, who killed three people at an annual festival, had been planning a larger attack. According to CBS, quote, investigators say they found a bulletproof vest, gas mask, knife, and gun pamphlets. The San Francisco Chronicle reports they also found reading materials on radical Islam and white supremacy. The Federal Reserve is set to cut interest rates this week for the first time in more than 10 years, in spite of the fact that conventional economic indicators show a relatively robust economy. According to the New York Times, quote, uncertainty around global growth and persistently low inflation are behind the expected move. And the Environmental Working Group released a report this week showing that recent farm subsidies intended to offset losses from Trump's trade war with China are in fact overwhelmingly going to the wealthiest agribusinesses. In other words, tax dollars are being used to make rich corporate farmers richer. Additionally, it has been found that almost 100% of all bailout funds went to white farmers. In Hawaii, Governor David Ige revoked his emergency proclamation allowing construction of the controversial 30-meter telescope, or TMT. The move was a victory for Native Hawaiians who have been blocking access to the summit of Mauna Kea on Hawaii's Big Island, where the TMT is to be built. But the governor also extended the time frame for construction by 2 years, indicating that the fight is not over. Puerto Rico's outgoing Governor Ricardo Rossello, who has been driven out by mass protests, has named another successor after the first one backed out. Pedro Pierluisi, who was the former Puerto Rican representative in the U.S. Congress, has apparently accepted the vacant position of state secretary and will take over as governor for the rest of Rossello's term after he steps down this Friday. In international news, North Korea has fired two short-range ballistic missiles this week, the second such firing, as a warning to South Korea over joint military exercises with the U.S. In Hong Kong, where pro-democracy protests continue, unknown assailants lobbed fireworks from a car at protesters, injuring nearly a dozen people. And Hong Kong police charged 44 people, including a 16-year-old girl, with rioting after they participated in an unpermitted protest. Finally, in Afghanistan, violence has once more broken out in the war-torn nation after a roadside bomb killed 32 people on a bus in the western province of Farah. At least 15 people were injured, many of them critically, and the death toll is expected to rise. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The 2020 presidential candidate debate pitted Democrat against Democrat and showcased the widening rift between so-called moderates and progressives within the party. But there was a third force present during the debate: the CNN moderators, who often echoed Republican talking points and even used the favored words of the extreme right wing to challenge candidates. The level of public discourse has become so toxic under President Donald Trump that one wonders if it's infecting us all. My guest is James Hogan, founder of the influential and award-winning website DSmog Blog. His earlier books include Do the Right Thing, PR Tips for a Skeptical Public, and Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. The second edition of his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, is just out. Welcome to the program, James.
Thanks for having me.
I should say welcome back. We had you on 3 years ago when the first edition of your book came out. When looking at the debates, and we've had two debates now, do you feel that the level of discourse, public discourse, that has just devolved so much under Trump is sort of infecting us all?
I think so. I think there's a kind of normalizing of, I think it's more than rudeness and lack of civility. It's almost like a normalizing and unyielding one-sidedness, and normalizing name calling or demonization of people who disagree with you. And I think we have to be very careful, even if we're on the right side of issues or we're comfortable with the ethical position or the morality of our position, we have to be careful to not fall into this creating this division or reinforcing this division. In my book, one of the things that I discovered as I interviewed these amazing people around the world, social scientists and public intellectuals, was that propaganda can pollute the public square, just like we can pollute the natural environment in toxic chemicals. And the way it does, the way propaganda pollutes is not just through disinformation, it's through division and through driving wedges between people. And so I think we need to be certainly standing up for what's right, and sometimes that divides people, just the reality of it. But we have to be careful not to take it too far so that we reinforce the unreasonableness that comes along with dividing the public into teams.
On the issue of immigration, for example, on the first night of the debate, you had the CNN moderators asking questions of the candidates that honestly just sounded like it was Fox News asking the question. You know, you were concerned that decriminalizing the border will just fuel illegal immigration. The framing of how we talk about things matters, right? And so a lot of that toxicity, a lot of the propaganda can be built into these assumptions and framings that especially those on the right are prone to. And then we hear a supposedly centrist media outlet echoing very similar things.
Yes, it's a, I mean, we, you know, I went to law school, and I remember in first year law being taught that we live, you know, in an adversarial system. The law is an adversarial system where you have the defense attorney and you have the prosecutor, and then you have the judge. And as I built my public relations business over the years, I used to hear other public relations people talk about the court of public opinion. And I remember realizing that that adversarial system that my professors in law school talked to me about is something that kind of pervades our communities today. And people prey on it. And we have systems problems with traditional media, with social media, that the algorithms of social media and the models that traditional media use are adversarial. Human beings have this, you know, we slow down to see an accident. You know, we like the, I don't know, there's something kind of more entertaining about these highly adversarial situations and disagreements. And I do think that a certain amount of polarization is absolutely healthy, and people need to passionately fight for what they think is right. But I think you can be 100% on track with truth at the same time that you're trying to be 100% on track with respecting the person who disagrees with you.
Right. I mean, the discourse at the Democratic debates was pretty civilized compared to the discourse at a Trump rally, for example, where you have our president denouncing, you know, sitting members of Congress and waiting for his audience to echo words like "send her back." So, you know, there is still some space within the public discourse that hasn't succumbed to Trump's toxicity.
That's right, and I think people know this, and it's good that, but it's more than civility that we're looking for, because I interviewed Jonathan Haidt, who studies the psychology of teams, and Dan Kahan at Yale Law School, who studies something called cultural cognition, which is this tendency that people have to shape evidence to fit the beliefs of their team, even if the evidence is pointing out that the beliefs of their team are wrong. And so we have a tendency to double down when we find we're wrong, and we look for things to reinforce our feelings that we're right. We try to ignore things that show that we're wrong. And so the psychology of teams is very powerful. And one of its greatest powers is that it shuts down open-minded thinking. And so when you create enemies and you create this us versus them narrative, particularly when you appeal to anger and resentment and hate, fear, those things kind of deepen this unreasonableness. And so civility, one of its purposes, I think, in public discourse is to just keep to allow people to think, and to think about not just what they believe, but what others believe, and how you have the conversation about where you find the common ground. I mean, that's basically what democracy is. So if you go in dividing people, like, it's very, very dangerous, and it essentially undermines democratic discourse.
One of the issues that you talk about in your book and that you just referred to is the undermining of public discourse can essentially shut down debate. So we hear from the Republicans, and I think South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg had a really good sort of rhetorical comeback to the standard Republican screaming and shouting that Democrats are all crazy socialists. This has become the new mode of attack by the Republican Party to shut down discourse, to label Democrats, quote, socialists. And Buttigieg, on the first night of the Democratic debate, said, look, they're going to call us that no matter what. They're going to call us crazy socialists if we adopt a position on the far left or if we adopt a position on, you know, that's conservative. So we might as well talk about the policies we really care about. Do you think that that's a good approach?
Absolutely right. I think it's absolutely right, because otherwise you end up telling their story. So if you become the liberal who's screaming back at the conservative, that's what they want. I mean, that's the whole purpose, is to divide and to create these distinctions and to nudge people into this kind of fact-free conversation where it doesn't matter what the evidence is saying, it's how creative the shrieking is.
Well, I think Buttigieg's point was that it almost doesn't matter what Democrats do. Republicans are going to lob this accusation to try to get it to stick no matter what. So you might as well say the right thing, you know, say what you really want to say and say it well.
Yeah, and be reasonable. And I think that is kind of a, not just a good strategy to for votes, it is a responsibility as far as democracy is concerned to not pollute public discourse. I mean, when you have a public square where people don't even think there's anything as such as a fact, or that evidence means just about the same thing as you know, someone's opinion, or you know, people don't feel that objectivity is what it should be, that it's really more whose side are you on, then that is not thinking. That Noam Chomsky said, it's that what's happening is that if you don't have an argument, shriek, yell, call people names, do anything you possibly can to distract people from the fact that you actually really don't have an argument that you could win.
And of course, the format of the debate unfortunately doesn't lend itself to healthy discourse. You know, 1 minute answers, 30 second retorts, 10 candidates in 3 hours. It certainly did not, unfortunately, give space for people to even fully complete their thoughts. So, for example, Bernie Sanders trying to talk about his Medicare for All bill, you know, barely had the chance to explain in detail what it would do. And then you had the so-called moderates on the debate who felt that maybe they were, I don't know if they didn't come out and say this, but they ended up echoing Republican talking points, perhaps because they're scared of being called a socialist. And so it was really interesting to see how some Democrats tend to edit themselves, hold themselves back, censor themselves, because they've maybe become so numb to, or so not numb to, so sensitive rather to Republican, you know, attacks.
Yeah. And I remember in a few years back, I had a chance to talk to a Vietnamese monk named Thich Nhat Hanh for the first edition of my book. And I was talking to him about advocacy, and he was saying how important it is to meditate, because it's in meditation that we become more thoughtful, and so we're better able to carry on public discourse about important issues. And I said, well, you're not saying people shouldn't be advocates, say for the environment, are you? And he looked at me and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish. And I think that there's a huge lesson in that short phrase, that focusing on how it is that we're 100% for what's right and what's true, at the same time that we avoid trying to punish the other person just because they're acting like an idiot or they're unreasonable or they appear to be a wrongdoer. I think part of it is trying to just really understand deeply what your story is and tell your story in a way, if you can, that's pluralistic and includes the people that you're talking to and even disagreeing with. And I think people who can master that, Obama was amazing at that. And I think that is the trick. It's not to get caught in these kind of juvenile name-calling contests.
You were the founder of the website Desmog Blog and wrote a book about how propaganda has derailed the debate over climate. And on the first night of the debate, while there was a discussion of climate, maybe one can sort of thank climate activists for pushing for that. But also on the outside of the debate, there were hundreds of climate justice activists demanding that there be more debate time spent on climate change. And the Sunrise Movement has pushed for CNN and MSNBC to hold forums, if not debates, on climate change. So that discourse between the public and people in power, or people looking, you know, to gain power, such as candidates for president, does that not have to be a more adversarial relationship?
Absolutely. And it, you know, what I'm talking about really isn't there's no intention on my part to suggest that we need to turn down the volume or be less adversarial. I think we can be adversarial without demonizing people who disagree with us. And I think that we just need to balance that. But I think the kind of activism that you just described, we need more of. We need more passion in public discourse, not less. The thing is, when you polarize things and drive the public square into these camps and create this kind of unyielding one-sidedness, this atmosphere of kind of almost like warlike disagreement, that is not more passion, that's less passion, that's not more speech, that's silencing. And so what I'm saying is just that it's a little bit finer point that be an advocate, absolutely, for sure. Thank God that we have Bill McKibben and Al Gore and people who are advocating on behalf of the environment. And sometimes industries deserve criticism and politicians deserve criticism and they should get it. So that's not what I'm talking about. This is more that we have to kind of connect with people emotionally, connect with people's values, and not get dragged into these highly polarized, perpetual fights, as opposed to conversations about how we deal with problems like climate change.
Now, just a few days before the Democratic debates, there was a white supremacist launched an attack on the annual Garlic Festival in Gilroy, California. Investigators found that he might have been planning an even bigger attack, and he was somehow influenced by these white supremacist texts. Is that sort of violence that we're seeing more and more of the unfortunate, predictable outcome of a tribalistic discourse that has just gotten completely out of control and that is so fueled by our commander in chief?
Yeah, I think that's true, and it's sadly true. I mean, this kind of evil is, it's just so hard to face and hard to explain, and you certainly can't talk to it. So, you know, you don't want to sit down and negotiate with evil. But I do think that what's happening now is that this kind of name calling and demonization and otherizing has given people permission and has created a normalization for things that are truly anti-democratic. These are not things that we expect in a healthy democracy, because essentially they're silencing minorities. They're, you know, one of the hallmarks of healthy democracy is reasonableness, you know, where people feel included and respected and part of public decisions that are made. Not, you don't want to feel like public policies are being jammed down your throat and you're being forced into a lesser role in the society that you live in.
So I'm wondering if you think that given the way in which the public discourse has devolved so badly over the last few years, that, you know, some might suggest that the response to it, you know, to try to be reasonable, unfortunately, doesn't work in the face of this kind of irrationality. But then what does work, you know, you can, for example, take climate change. You can talk about climate change. You can point to all the scientific facts. You can try to include people, point out that we are all, our existence is all at stake here. We're all in this, you know, climate change is not really going to discriminate. Well, except the rich will probably have ways to protect themselves. But the rest of us won't. And the counter argument is just, well, you're wrong. You know, and here's the Heritage Foundation or any of these other climate denying outlets that get so much coverage in the media, and the discourse doesn't go anywhere. You know, how does one respond to irrational anger, and that's so toxic?
Yeah, and I think that is the tricky question that activists and public figures ask themselves about not just climate change, but a whole range of issues like immigration and gun control and you know, the cost of healthcare and so on. I believe that we need to get better, public figures need to get better at storytelling. Because people think in stories. We understand the world through stories. Since we were little children listening to stories, we understand what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. We understand how things work, how we should be in the world and what the world should be like, what fairness and justice is. And I think that too many of us have, particularly many scientists in this whole area of climate change, it's changing. But early on, people just made this false assumption that people were more reasonable than they actually are. They're more interested in facts than they actually are. And that evidence and facts will eventually come to the surface. Now, that may in fact be true, but we, with climate change, it's one of those particular kind of problems where you don't have a lot of time to sit around and wait.
Well, finally, in the 3 years since your book came out, I am wondering, and between your first and second editions, we've had, you know, 3 years of, you know, of very much coarsening of the public discourse, much more so than probably the 3 years before your first edition came out. What did you learn? What were some of the new parts of the book that you put in the second edition based on just the last 3 years?
Yes, well, I think the most important addition to this new book is the work that I did on Cambridge Analytica and the role that it played in the 2016 presidential election in the States and in Brexit. And I took a really close look at that whole kind of corrupt process and how it worked. And then looked at the analysis that a lot of academics have of the role that Facebook has been playing in this polarization problem. And I think Facebook is a very, very dangerous technology. I think Google is as well, YouTube. And the reason I think that is because the way the algorithms work is they make it more convenient and much easier for people who have this knowledge of how the social psychology of dividing people. The people who have that knowledge, the tools of social media are a very, very powerful asset for them because these algorithms tend to favor negative emotions. So anyone whose narrative is around resentment or is around hate or fear is going to get more attention than the Dalai Lama talking about compassion. And so this is social media has made all of this problem of propaganda that's focusing on dividing people far worse. And in addition to that, you basically have the ability to micro-target people. So some, you know, Cambridge Analytica, when it was doing all this manipulation around the 2016 election, it was able to take an ad and do between 40 and 50,000 versions of the ad.
Well, James, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and wish you good luck with the new edition of your book.
Well, thank you for having me.
My guest has been James Hogan, founder of the influential and award-winning website DSmog Blog. And we've been talking about the second edition of his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. At the age of 13, Jana Jihad has had more experience as a journalist and war correspondent than most young journalism graduates. The Palestinian teenager has been reporting from the occupied West Bank since the age of 7, documenting the abuses of Israeli soldiers and settlers at great personal risk. The cousin of teen activist Ahed Tamimi, Jana has been touring the U.S. for several weeks now, speaking with congressional representatives and addressing packed audiences around the U.S. She now joins me on the program. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining us. What has it been like? What have these past few weeks been like for you here in the United States, speaking to audiences of a country whose tax dollars has actively supported the occupation of your lands?
It's been pretty cool talking to people and trying to raise awareness about what's happening. As a Palestinian child living under the Israeli military occupation, trying to talk about how we as Palestinian children, how our rights are getting violated and everything. It's been pretty cool. And, you know, as you said, like, your taxes are getting, like, going to Israel, and they're using it to kill and arrest and, you know, ill treat children. And that's why we're also trying to raise awareness about HR 2407, Betty McCollum's bill, No Way to Treat a Child. This legislation is basically trying to call to end the funding of the U.S. To just, like, arrest children and, you know, all of that in any country in the world, including Palestine.
Now, I understand that you were born in the United States. You're Palestinian-American?
I was born in the United States, but I didn't live here. So, like, I lived only for, like, 3 months and then went back to Palestine.
I see. So you've spent the vast majority of your life as a Palestinian in Palestine.
Yeah, all of my life.
So tell me about what it was that led you to document the abuses around you as a journalist. And I mentioned you're Ahed Tamimi's cousin. So between the two of you, you've garnered a tremendous amount of attention to what Palestinians are going through, which is a remarkable achievement for essentially children. I mean, you guys are children doing the work that adults should be doing, many adults are doing, but you're doing it quite effectively. So what led you to become a journalist?
So I started journalism when I was only 7 years old, when I realized that there were not enough journalists to cover things that happened in Nabi Saleh, specifically in Nabi Saleh and also in Palestine in general. Like when my friend Mustafa was killed, my uncle Rishdi was killed, a lot of things were happening in the world, didn't know how we felt as Palestinian children living under this Israeli military occupation. How we're suffering every day, how our rights are getting violated, how we're getting injured, arrested, and killed. So I wanted to be the voice of those children and try to raise awareness about what's happening with us and how we're living under this Israeli military occupation.
I want to play for our audience a short video of you in your element in the West Bank confronting Israeli soldiers. There's a number of them, and there was a lot of video of you speaking in Arabic and English. We have the English part of it isolated.
From here, as you can see, those terrorist people, humans with no humanity, are coming to our land, trying to kill children and to make children get injured. From here, we're sending our message and saying that Palestine will be free.
Now, you showed very little fear there. What are those confrontations like for you? Because, of course, Israeli soldiers are not above physically harming or even arresting and imprisoning children your age.
So, of course, you know, I was scared there, but we control our fears and not let our fears control us, because if our fears control us, we're not going to live. And yeah, as you saw there, the Israeli occupation soldiers surrounded me and tried to stop me from reporting and try to also, you know, just not give me my freedom of speech while I was doing nothing wrong and while I was only trying to raise awareness about what's happening at the moment. So it basically shows how my right of freedom of speech as a journalist is getting violated. And yeah, it's pretty hard for me as a journalist to try to document whatever is happening.
What was it like when your cousin Ahed Tamimi was imprisoned for a length of time? She garnered a lot of attention to the fact that Israel imprisons children. But of course, she is also your cousin. So this must have been a very terrifying time.
Ahed is my cousin and my best friend. So it's been, you know, one of the hardest experiences in my life, because, you know, Ahed is the one who would just like, I'd always hang out with her. She'd pick me out of school. We'd just go all around the village. We'd just have sleepovers. We'd just do everything together. It was pretty hard for me to just, you know, lose her. And I couldn't communicate with her, visit her, talk to her at the moment. When she was in jail for 8 months just for trying to defend her house and her land, she was imprisoned for 8 months, and when she was only 16 years old. And I was only one of hundreds of children who got arrested, and her case isn't even the hardest. So just looking at how we as Palestinian children are getting imprisoned, and how we are getting, you know, during this arrest we got subjected to a lot of stuff. Like, for example, one of them is interrogation, which we get subjected in it to physical violence, get out of it with like psychological and mental issues. We can be traumatized, we can get subjected to solitary confinement, we got long-term handcuffed, blindfolded. And in the Israeli military law, it says if you're only 12 years old and up, you can get arrested, interrogated, treated like a criminal. That's if you're only a Palestinian child. Unlike the Israeli children who get subjected to only like normal civilian courts. So we have a lot of children who are only 12 years old and even under 12 years old. Like 2 days ago, I read about a child who was was called for an interrogation, and he's only 5 years old. And you know, this illegal law that a 12 years old child can get arrested is also getting broken. For example, last year my cousin Samir got arrested when he was only 11 years old. So it's very traumatizing for us just to think about that in any moment we as Palestinian children can get arrested or killed or injured.
Now, the U.S. President Donald Trump has been a seemingly even greater friend to Israel than previous U.S. presidents. And during his tenure, we've seen greater impunity. We've seen the move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And we've seen also just this week, while 700 homes were approved, Palestinian homes were approved to be built in the West Bank, 6,000 settler homes were also approved, a nearly tenfold difference in the two. What has Trump's rule in the U.S. been like for residents of the West Bank?
It's been pretty bad because, you know, Trump is trying to show the world that he's playing the role of the mediator in this issue, but he's basically is the Israeli lawyer, and he's playing the role of the Israeli lawyer. They're, like, you know, declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel, moving the embassy and a lot of stuff. And it's been pretty bad for us as Palestinians because, for example, in the West Bank itself, we have 68% of the West Bank is illegal settlements. And it's pretty bad, and he's not doing anything about it. It's illegal internationally. And he's just supporting all of that, and he's standing up with the occupiers and with the people who are killing the children.
And Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has apparently authored a peace plan that he's going to be touting in Israel this week. And Trump has called that peace plan the deal of the century. Some of it is apparently referring to economic investment in Palestinian communities. Do you have any trust of Jared Kushner to come up with a peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians?
So first thing, the deal of the century, we as the Palestinian government, we didn't sign on it, and which means it won't even, you know, it's not a thing, because it's basically, it says that we have to live in this area surrounded by Israeli occupation surrounding us and just not getting our freedom. And of course, we're against all of that, and we refuse for that deal to just go. And we don't trust Jared Kushner, because, like, what, he's like super pro occupation and pro settlements and pro killing of children. So of course we would never trust anybody like that, and we won't agree on anything that would violate our rights as Palestinian.
Now, you mentioned that you have been here in the U.S., and among the things that you've been doing is meeting with members of Congress and their staff to address the bill that would curb the imprisonment of Palestinian children. Has the inclusion of some younger pro-Palestinian members of Congress made a difference? I'm talking specifically about Rashida Tlaib, who is, of course, a Palestinian-American, the first Palestinian-American member of Congress, and Ilhan Omar. Together, Ms. Omar and Ms. Tlaib are the first two Muslim-American members of Congress, and the two of them have taken pretty strong stands in support of Palestinians.
Yeah, they're basically supporting human rights, and they're basically supporting equality to all the people around the world, including the Palestinians, which basically is right. And for the, like, 2 weeks ago, I've been in Washington meeting with some senators and representatives talking about trying to raise awareness about what's happening in Palestine, and also trying to talk about the H.R. 2407, Betty McCollum's bill. I interviewed Betty McCollum. I interviewed Rashida Tlaib. So it was pretty cool, and it was nice to raise awareness about what's happening. It's like Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, all of those people that are supporting human rights issue, like that are supporting human rights, that are anti-occupation, we're very proud of, and we look up to them.
Ilhan Omar in particular has been condemned for speaking out for Palestinian rights, and denounced as anti-Semitic. There's also been a criminalization of boycott efforts here in the United States. The U.S. House of Representatives just passed, with support from both major parties, a bill that would affirm the right to not boycott, or, you know, that would criminalize the boycotting of Israel. Do you see a double standard? I mean, America's all about free speech, but we can't boycott Israel.
So, look, they're saying that Ilhan Omar is anti-Semitic, but she's basically anti-Zionist, not anti-Semitic. And for anyone who speaks for Palestine, even I was, like, talked about that I'm anti-Semitic, but I'm not anti-Semitic. A lot of Jewish the Jewish activists are, they just say that they're anti-Semitic, but they are Jewish and they won't be against themselves, but they are against the occupation and they are against Zionism. They are against killing children. And religions doesn't have, any religion doesn't have to interfere with any political issue, with any killing, because religions are, like, Zionism is different than Judaism, because Judaism is just a religion. We're against Zionism. We're not against Judaism. So,
and how do you define Zionism?
So Zionism is basically Israel, or Israelis, or like the killing of people. The Israelis who are killing people, who they are Zionists, and they are just like, you know, they're pro killing, pro arresting, pro settlements, pro violation of rights. But it doesn't. If you're anti-Zionist, doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic, because there are a lot of Jewish people that are anti-Zionist. And of course, it's like BDS and like boycotting is one of the very peaceful ways to resist. And it's supposed to be legal, you know, because basically a lot of people before us used it. For example, the South Africans used it against apartheid here in America. It was used against the racism like tens of years ago. And yeah, so it's very confusing to see, you know, a country that defines itself as a, you know, just outspeaking country that anybody can express themselves, and they're just basically criminalizing one of the most peaceful ways to resist an occupation.
I understand that one of the events that you spoke at here in the U.S. during your tour was with Mark Lamont Hill, who is a well-known black activist, speaker, journalist, professor, who was fired as a CNN commentator after speaking up for Palestinian rights. How important is solidarity from folks like Mark Lamont Hill?
So it's very important. Mark Lamont Hill is someone that I am very proud of. And, you know, he's just so amazing that he stood up for us. He stood up for our rights as Palestinians, for our rights as children around the world, for, like, the rights of the black children, the rights of the Palestinian children, like, etc. And, you know, it's really amazing to see people like him. And it's very important to have more folks like Mark Lamont Hill in our world. And, you know, we're trying to just tell the world that we just want to live in peace like any other person around the world. We have to hold Israel accountable for every single thing that is happening. We have to stand up for our rights and for everything. Because if you're against the killing of the black children here in America, you have to be against the killing of any other child around this world, including the Palestinian children. If you're against the children in cages on the border, you have to be against the detaining and the arresting of the Palestinian children in Palestine.
So the while you've been on tour in the United States, have you been subjected to any opposition? Because it's, you know, being a Palestinian rights activist or speaking about Palestinian rights in the U.S. often invites attacks from pro-Zionist organizations and individuals. It's a very well-organized machine, unfortunately, here in the U.S., well-funded as well. Have you been attacked at all by people during your speaking tour?
When I had the meeting with Mark Lamont Hill in New York, we found some JDL people coming.
Jewish Defense League.
Yeah, they came and wanted to stop us, and then we had to call the police for them to get out of there. And there were a couple of people, you know, a lot of some articles were written by Jihad Watch, and, you know, a lot of anti-Muslim, anti-Palestine, and super, like, pro-Zionist organizations and, like, stuff like that. So, of course, and also on my page, I received, you know, some messages and stuff. So, yeah.
Did you receive threats on your social media?
Of course, I always receive threats, especially, you know, for example, last year, I was, the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs made a secret report about me saying that I'm the next threat on their country. And it was revealed by the Israeli News Channel 4. And after that, I, you know, got registered by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate. And after that, you know, because it was revealed, I got a lot of threatenings and intimidations by the Israeli community in the Israeli street. And after that, I also was interrogated while coming back from Jordan for 3 hours on the border while I was only 12 years old in 4 days. So, of course, I get a lot of threatenings and intimidations from people.
And I just want to mention to our audience that your U.S. tour is continuing, and you're going to be heading, you're right now in Oregon as you and I are speaking, you're going to be heading to Southern California, where our program is based, with a number of events happening Saturday, August 3rd at 2 p.m. in San Diego, Sunday, August 4th at the Arab American Community Center in Anaheim, and that's at 3 p.m., and Tuesday, August 6th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles. And we'll post all of that information on our website for people interested in attending. What is your ultimate goal, Jana, as we wrap up our conversation? What is your ultimate goal being here in the United States? Obviously, as a journalist, you're doing the job of a journalist by interviewing people as well. But what would you like Americans to take from your events?
You know, I basically came here to speak about our rights as Palestinian children and how it's getting violated. Basically, like, to raise awareness about how we're living under this Israeli occupation, how our rights are being violated, how there are checkpoints in our ways, how our schools are getting raided. And I'm just trying to show what's happening and speak about it. And of course, you as Americans can do a lot of stuff. For example, also, we had our initiative called Shamsan 3 years ago, which is basically a platform for the Palestinian children to raise their stories. And we interviewed about 300 child and made them draw something about their lives. One of them was Ahmed Dawabshi, which he was a 4 years old child at the time, and his whole family was burned alive while sleeping in their village, in their house, by a settler, and including his 18 months old brother, and he was the only, you know, survivor from like his family, and when he was only 4 years old, and it was pretty hard. He drew a lot of stuff, and we were trying to just raise awareness about what's happening, about those children's stories, like, you know, about like what's happening in Palestine. So basically, you guys have to basically raise awareness about what's happening. You have to stand up and try to tell your government to hold Israel accountable of their, you know, just with the stuff that they're doing, and basically not, you know, not supporting Israel by your name, you guys, because you're basically paying taxes and your money is basically going and killing, getting used to detaining children and getting children getting injured and children getting killed and stuff. You guys have to stand up for your rights, and you guys have to, we all have to unite to make this world a world of peace, a world of love, a world of equality and justice, to liberate Palestine and to let every single child around this world live the childhood they deserve.
Jana, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I understand you are quite active, of course, on social media, especially with your journalism work. Can you give out your Twitter or Facebook or any other social media pages that people can follow what you do?
Of course, on my Facebook, it's just called Jana Jihad. So you guys can find my reports over there. I have a lot of, like, my reports are basically concentrated on my Facebook. My other pages, like Instagram, is like, are more like personal. But it's like my reports. You can find them on Facebook, on my page, or you can just Google my name on YouTube, on Google, whatever. So yeah,
Facebook.com/Jana JANNA Jihad, JIHAD. We'll post a link to that as well as other social media pages and information about your upcoming events on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. Jana, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye.
My guest has been Jannat Jihad, a 13-year-old Palestinian activist, journalist, and speaker currently on tour in the U.S. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest's third show on Saturday, August 10th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote hip-hop and R&B artists who are local to the Pacific Northwest, with an emphasis on showcasing artists who are Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Their upcoming showcase features Timi Hendrix, Zenith, Charlie Fairfax, and Kayla J. Again, that's Project Northwest's third show on Saturday, August 10th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It is 7 o'clock. Up next, Flashpoints.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, What is Democracy? A new hard-hitting documentary by award-winning filmmaker Astra Taylor. It's coming at you straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Just want to let you know that we're going to be